Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for joining us. Today, we focus our attention on what it takes to run an auto company and the future of Michigan's automakers. Then we'll meet a real-life Rosie the Riveter. She helped turn out bombers at Willow Run nearly 70 years ago. Later in the program, we'll get a preview of this year's Traverse City Film Festival. That kicks off this week. But first, it's been just over 2 weeks since Detroit became the largest city in American history to file for bankruptcy protection under Chapter 9. Up till then, that unwanted distinction belonged to Stockton, California. Earlier this year, Bridge magazine writer Ron French visited bankrupt Stockton, and he also visited Vallejo, a California town that's emerged from bankruptcy. As Ron puts it, if Stockton is an example of a city just being diagnosed with fiscal cancer, Vallejo is a community that has finished chemotherapy. And so far, nobody seems particularly thrilled with the results. Ron French, welcome back to Stateside.
It's good to be here, Cynthia.
Well, let's start with what you found in Stockton currently going through bankruptcy. How has life been for people there?
A lot like Detroit in that people, if you go out in the street of Detroit today and say, what's it like to live in a bankrupt city? They say, well, pretty much like it was 2 weeks ago. It's been a long process, and things have gone downhill there over a number of years. And I think there are enough at the beginning of the process, just like Detroit, where residents are a bit numb and they really don't know what to expect. And so there's still everyone, including officials there, just really don't know how it's going to turn out for them yet.
So there's a general demoralization that's happened as the ground has eroded. I'm wondering in what have been the ways that Stockton's financial unraveling mirrored what's happening in Detroit. They sure were generous to their city employees, weren't they?
Yeah, well, that's something they have in common. What you see in a lot of these cities is benefits being given out when times were good. Mm-hmm. And what you had were very generous benefits in both Stockton and Vallejo for city employees that ended up being unsustainable once the housing market collapsed. And in these cities, the housing values dropped a lot like in Detroit. They dropped more than between 50 and 70%.
Boy.
And so your property taxes take a nosedive, and suddenly there's no way to pay the pensions and pay the health care and pay the salaries that you're offering to the city employees.
It's pretty staggering when, as you report, some former workers in Stockton were earning more in retirement than they did while they were working.
There was a loophole. And everyone learned how to use it, where you got paid 3% of your final year salary times the number of years you worked.
Yeah.
But that last year, you could bump up your salary by – you could accumulate vacation over all your years you worked there if you wanted to, count it all in your last year. You could count all your overtime. And so what they would do, because your number's going to come up sometime,
yeah,
they'd give all the overtime assignments to the people who are going to retire that year. And so knowing that later on they'd probably get taken care of in the same way. Well, it's good while it lasted, but someone had to pay the piper eventually.
And the city also borrowed very heavily, didn't it, for huge, huge civic improvements. Were they worthwhile improvements?
Not at the moment.
Give us an example of the kinds of...
Sure. There's a huge mall and a marina in downtown Stockton. Very nice. A huge movie theater. And it's very nice. In fact, they purchased the building and rehabbed it for the new city hall. Well, they ended up selling it before they even moved in. The theater... when I was there, it was an opening for one of the big blockbuster movies. I don't remember which one.
Mm-hmm.
I was down there in the evening, and there was no one at this huge multiplex. And I asked, what's going on? He says, well, people are scared to come here. So they had this bright, shining, symbol of things are great instead of putting money into the neighborhoods for street lights, for extra police. Mm-hmm. So at the same time they were cutting police by about 50%, they were building this huge thing, thinking this is the way to go. And so tourists might come down there and think this looks nice, but as soon as they drive into the neighborhoods, a lot like you see in Detroit, you see that there are major problems.
Ron, since the city's gone into the bankruptcy, what have been the major problems stemming from all of that? Has it been more crime? Has it been more city services? Both?
Well, Stockton just went into bankruptcy, yeah. so there's not been a lot of change. But over that period of time in Stockton, over the last few years, you've seen a major increase in crime, which, not shockingly, was related to higher unemployment. And then as property values dropped, then they laid off a lot of police. The lower the police protection, the more the crime went up.
Very familiar song. One of the things so many of reports have focused on in the Detroit story is Detroit's assets. So Belle Isle, the DIA masterpieces. Did Stockton have assets equivalent to that that are being sold off or could be sold off?
Not to my knowledge, no.
So nothing,
no.
Nothing like the –
they don't have a garage sale with Monet. Monet is in there. So they don't – can't even go to that even if Detroit wanted to. And I'm sure most people do not want that to happen. Yeah. Stockton does not have that to fall back on.
Now let's go over to Vallejo. What's the bankruptcy story with Vallejo?
Well, they just emerged from bankruptcy. So
how long?
About 3 years. And it was very painful and it was very divisive as you're starting to see a little bit in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And so that's something you want to look at as whether you see the same sort of things happening here. How divisive was it? Someone brought a severed pig's head into the city council meeting.
Okay.
Someone burned down the law office of the mayor. Someone stole the mayor's Harley Davidson from the city parking lot right outside his office. It was not a good time. The police were and fire put up billboards, complaining about the situation. It got so bad when the city was planning to lay off more police officers that the police chief announced publicly in the newspaper that police are no longer going to respond to burglaries.
Wow.
So you can guess what happened the next day.
Skyrocketing burglaries.
Absolutely.
If one really gets the impression from reading your story, Ron French, that just about everyone dislikes everyone else in Vallejo. So the bankruptcy has really done something to the mindset and the overall energy of people there, hasn't it?
Well, there's two sides of it. In Vallejo, absolutely. There's been a lot of contention. But what residents have had to do, and this is something that if you look for any silver lining,
yeah.
Okay, they have gone out and decided they have to take care of themselves, that the police are not going to come and take care of my home. So we have to figure out how to do it ourselves. In Vallejo, there are over 400 neighborhood watches, and these are active neighborhood watches. And to give you an example of what that would mean, for Detroit, for the comparable population, that would mean 2,500 neighborhood watches in Detroit. That's the same sort of mm-hmm. equivalency.
Okay.
And there's an online newsletter that spreads tips between these different neighborhood watches. Where is being burglarized now? How are they getting in? That because they know that the police aren't responding, so they say we're going to take care of it ourselves. And if you're looking for any sort of silver lining in Vallejo, it's that at the end of this process, mm-hmm. you're finding some residents taking over and running for office and joining. PTAs, things like that, say that we can't let the city go down any farther. And so we're going to do it ourselves.
Instead of waiting for them, whoever
Absolutely.
They may be. What has happened to Vallejo's debt after emerging from bankruptcy? Did it make a difference or are they still struggling with a budget deficit?
It made a difference. It helped. But, and this is something else that the city manager Vallejo mentioned, that he said if he had any piece of advice for Detroit is that if you declare bankruptcy, which they obviously mm-hmm, now have, mm-hmm. Don't be timid about it. You know, if you're going to rip the bandage off, you know, do it quickly and cut even more than you think you need to. Because they went in and tried to, you know, do as little as they had, try to make people as happy as they could, and they have emerged from bankruptcy. And this year, they don't know how they're going to balance their budget this year. They are still $5 million in debt for a city that size. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And they don't know where they're going to come up with that money. They think they may go back into some sort of process again.
So we've seen Kevin Orr being very consistent in saying that he wants to do this quickly. He wants to get city services up to an acceptable level. From what you've seen in Vallejo and what you saw in Stockton, is that goal compatible with going through bankruptcy?
Not if you look at Stockton and Vallejo.
Yes.
You can do it quickly, you can cut deep, but that's hard to increase city services at the same time that you're cutting deep. Who's going to screw in all those light bulbs that are needed in Detroit? Someone has to do it. It's It's going to be tough. It's a very tough process. Vallejo said it was any way to avoid it, don't do it. Obviously, Kevin Orr chose to feel that there is no way to avoid it. But you know, as far as getting city services increased at the same time that you're trying to cut all this, I think it's going to be tough if you use Vallejo and Stockton as an example.
Did you talk to anyone in Stockton or in Vallejo who had anything encouraging or positive to say about the municipal bankruptcy that they went through or are going through?
No. Even the city manager of Vallejo who oversaw it said, do anything you can to avoid it. And he said it's been brutal. We had to do it. It got to the point. It's just like if you had cancer, if you have to have a surgery, you got to do it. It's not something you're going to look forward to. Your life may not be much better afterward, but you got to do it to stay alive. The only thing, as I said, that has been positive is that things got so bad in Vallejo that the residents decided to take matters in their own hands. And eventually, I think that probably will be a positive thing for the city.
Ron French's piece on the bankruptcy experiences of Stockton and Vallejo, California, appeared in a May edition of Bridge Magazine. We have put a link to his story on our stateside page at michiganradio.org. Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up, she installed radios in the flight decks of B-24 bombers. A real-life Rosie the Riveter. That story in 10 minutes. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. While Detroit embarks on the beginning days of its bankruptcy, the city's big three automakers are reemerging from their own financial crises. It was 4 years ago that GM and Chrysler filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. We wanted to turn our attention on just what it takes to run a major auto company and the future of Michigan's automakers. Joining us is someone who knows all about running auto companies, Bob Lutz. He has held top positions at General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, BMW. His most recent position was that of vice chairman of GM from 2001 to 2010. His newest book gives us the behind-the-scenes look at the bosses Bob Lutz has worked for, some of the most legendary names in auto history. The book is called Icons and Idiots. Bob Lutz, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be with you.
What do you feel, Bob Lutz, is the single most important trait that a good leader must have? What might help someone overcome maybe their idiot side?
Well, the most important bedrock, the foundation of it all, is integrity and honesty. If a leader doesn't possess that, then all the other characteristics, you know, the communication skills, the command presence, it's all for naught if the person doesn't possess integrity. And I think here in Michigan, we saw a recent example of that in the case of Kwame Kilpatrick, mayor of Detroit, where everybody said, gee, what a shame that he was a crook. He was a brilliant leader. Well, he possessed some traits of the brilliant leader, but the foundation of honesty and integrity was missing.
And in the book, I have to tell you, Bob Lutz, I was totally taken by surprise at the way that you characterized Henry Ford II. Share that characterization with our listeners.
I described him as very urbane, very well-spoken. He wore very expensive clothes, but they were always rumpled, which is kind of the sign of the upper classes. You know, he was as close to aristocracy as we can get in the United States. Partially raised in Europe, he spoke French. He was very cultured. He was in many ways a very effective leader. He had this quiet dignity and this quiet authority. I never once heard him raise his voice, and yet everybody. I won't say they feared him, but yeah, there was something frightening about the emotional size of the man. I thought he was a phenomenal leader.
And you said gentle, deferential, and painfully polite.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, when you look at the near-death experiences of GM and Chrysler in particular, having to beg for government aid, at least Ford didn't need to do that. But what do you think that you and other top execs could have done differently and earlier, or should have done, or shouldn't have done, that might have averted such a disastrous period?
I think looking back, and hindsight is always 20/20, we should have focused on great cars much earlier, as opposed to telling ourselves that we were in the mass market. We don't do premium cars. We do cars that are, you know, just good enough to get by, and we want to produce them at low cost and make lots of money on them and so forth. And that was the wrong strategy at a time when the imports were just doing ever more excellent cars. Then I think unquestionably we gave in far too often to the United Automobile Workers because we were desirous of avoiding a strike. And there again, people who say, well, you guys should have been tougher with the union. Well, the union strike fund was so big that the union could have lasted for 11 or 12 months on total strike, like shutting down GM or shutting down Ford. The union could easily survive that. An automobile company cannot survive 3 months of no production without going Chapter 11. And then what we did is, as with the industry gradually got into more and more financial difficulty, we borrowed more and more money, and an ever greater portion of the profits that we made from making cars was used to pay down interest. And towards the end there, General Motors' health care bill alone was $7 billion a year. That's on a revenue base for General Motors North America of $100 billion. So 7% of our revenue was going to health care. I mean, it was just a crippling burden. So, yeah, we should have, those problems all should have been addressed 10 or 20 years earlier.
And finally, Bob, give us your thoughts on the direction of America's auto industry today.
Oh, that's all good news. I think all three companies are producing the best cars in their history, and they're all hugely successful. The companies have finally realized what I've been preaching for years, which is if you build a beautiful car with nice craftsmanship, good road manners, good fuel economy, and great reliability, people are willing to pay more for that. And it's true. I mean, the average transaction prices for American cars are up about, even inflation adjusted, they're up about $5,000 from where they used to be. And selling more cars, and now selling cars profitably. And I think that you can now see that all three of the current CEOs have gotten it.
Bob Lutz, author of the new book, Icons and Idiots, Straight Talk on Leadership. It is out from Portfolio Penguin. Pleasure talking with you, Bob. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie, the riveter, when they gave her a production knee, she was as proud as a girl could be. There's something true about red, white, and blue about Rosie, the riveter.
That song from 1942, written by Red Evans and John Jacob Loeb, celebrates one of the most important groups to emerge on the home front in World War II. Collectively known as Rosie the Riveter, women covered their hair with bandanas, picked up their tools, and went to work in war production at factories all across America. One of the most important plants in the war effort was the Willow Run Bomber Plant in Ypsilanti Township. Henry Ford built it to make B-24 bombers, the Liberator. 8,685 bombers rolled off the assembly line at Willow Run during the war. Joining us today is one of those Rosie the Riveters. Emma Rancor worked at Willow Run. She installed radios in the flight decks of those Liberators. These days, Emma lives in South Lyon. Welcome to the program, Emma.
Thank you.
You were 19 when you came to work at Willow Run. Were you excited or were you scared?
Well, I guess it was a little bit both. I've never been in a big factory like that before.
And so when you came to work there, describe it for us if you can. What were the sounds and what was the feel of the plant when it was, here it was, turning out a B-24 every 55 minutes? What do you remember most?
Well, mostly it's just going to work and doing my work and seeing so many people in one place. That was unusual for me. And knowing that people were coming from all over Michigan to work there, and they had a lot of mileage to put in, coming and going. And we worked, I think it was that time, I think we worked 8, 9, or 10 hours.
Meantime, there weren't many boys around, were there?
No, there wasn't. There was a lot of them in the factory, but they were either women or old men. We got along like a big family.
Very big. I know when you see there were some 42,000 workers at Point. What did you like most about working at Willow Run during World War II?
Well, to be honest with you, I was just happy to have a job.
Was there a sense that you were helping the war effort? Were you thinking in that way?
Yes. We never really talked about it. We all understood it, and that was it. You was there to do what you could do.
There were 12 million American women working in 1940 and 20 million.
Well,
by
I don't know if there was a lot, but I didn't.
You know, well, across the country, would you think about the big change, the big important social and economic change because of women like you, with starting with 12 million American women working in 1940 and 20 million by 1944? That was a big 57% jump. Did you have any sense that you were making American history when you were punching in every day at Willow Run?
Well, I never really thought of it that way. I mean, we were there to do a job, and we all did our job.
Emma, what did you do after the war?
I got married and had a baby, became a housewife.
Was your husband was he serving overseas?
No, he was working there with me.
So Willow Run gave you your husband?
Honestly, yes.
Now, you visited Willow Run not that long ago. Tell us, how did it feel walking back in there again after some 70 years?
Well, it's nothing like I can remember it because, you know, we had the planes there. But what mostly it is it was displayed, which with now is nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like going to an empty house after, you know, you've seen furniture in there, but you come in and after a while, and it's just a big room.
A little bit sad, maybe, thinking of what had been there.
Well, no, there was also nice memories of the people that we met. And we, like I say, to us, it was the idea we were helping, or at least we thought we were helping. We felt we were like we were helping. And it was a good satisfaction. You don't think about a lot of things like that at the time when things happen. After a while, you think about it later on, yeah.
Sure. But what would you like to have us know about what it was like to be in that plant? What's the most important thing we should know about what you and the other women did at Willow Run during the war?
I mean, everybody did. It came from so many different areas of Michigan. We knew even we had that many cities in Michigan. And from way up north and that, some people had to drive almost 4 hours just to get down there and go 4 hours, go home. I thought that was quite an achievement for those people.
Emma, is it hard to believe that it's been 70 years since you were reporting to work there?
Yes and no. I'm 88. And I'll be 89 in September. Yeah, it's kind of hard to think that I've gone through a lifetime where there was a war in my lifetime, and then I've worked in it. I didn't think I'd ever going to be 88. So...
Well, Emma, thank you for talking with us today on Stateside.
Well, okay, I'm glad I could help you.
Emma Roncour worked at Willow Run in Ypsilanti, installing radios in the flight decks of those B-24 Liberator bombers. You may recall the Save the Willow Run Bomber Plant campaigns, trying to preserve at least a part of the old plant to be used for the Yankee Air Museum. But unless they can raise $3.5 million more by Thursday, it appears the plant will be demolished. When it comes to connecting with those who have gone before us, learning from them, discovering the differences and the similarities between us and, let's say, great-great-grandma's generation, you just can't beat a letter. The words and thoughts that someone puts down on paper can speak clearly through the years and the centuries, and they're worth heeding. That's the idea behind Michigan in Letters, an online collection. One of the contributors to Michigan in Letters is my next guest. He's with the Clark Historical Library at Central Michigan University. John Fierst, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us exactly what is in the Michigan in Letters collection.
It's actually many collections in the Clark Library. The idea behind Michigan in Letters was to feature some of these collections that we have by editing and presenting items in those collections. A good example is the first collection we dealt with in Michigan in Letters was letters about Sarah Edmonds, who was a woman who disguised herself as a man and joined the Union Army in the Civil War.
So you have a letter in the collection from Sarah who joined the U.S. Army as a man using the name Frank Thompson. Give us a little bit more about her story and then tell us about her letter.
Sarah was originally Canadian, and she left Canada. She had been married. It was kind of a forced marriage, and she was very unhappy about it. And she had also lived under a rather tyrannical father. And so she left on her own, and she traveled as a Bible salesman, disguising herself as a man. And she ended up in Flint, Michigan at the time that the Civil War broke out. And she decided to volunteer for the Union cause, and under the alias of Frank Thompson, she joined the U.S. Army, Company F, 2nd Michigan Volunteer Infantry Regiment, in May of 1861.
Yes, and served as a spy and a nurse and a mail courier. So you have in the Michigan Letters collection on the website, you have a transcription of a letter from Sarah Edmonds Seeley as she's looking for a boost in her pension.
My kind friend, I herein give you a statement of facts in regard to the accident referred to in my letter. Said accident occurred on the day of the Second Battle of Bull Run, while on my way with the mail from Washington to our troops near Centerville. I was trying with all my might to reach Berry's brigade before the battle commenced, and in order to do so, I took advantage of every near cut that I possibly could by leaping fences and ditches instead of going a long way round.
Now, in addition to Sarah Edmonds Seeley's letter, there are so many other letters. Give us an idea of who are some of the other folks who are in your collection. You have politicians and settlers?
That's correct. Well, the very first three entries we had were actually all women. The second entry we put up was about Hannah Bingham, who was the wife of the Baptist missionary Abel Bingham. He was a missionary to the Ojibwe and was stationed at Sault Ste. Marie. And the Clark Library has a very large collection of Bingham letters and papers. And in that, there's a number of diaries that Hannah kept herself. And so the letter that we put up was the letter was actually an entry out of her diary talking about her trip to Sault Ste. Marie, crossing Lake Huron. Her letter, her writings really give you a view of what it was like to be the wife of a missionary.
We came about a dozen miles yesterday in an open boat against the wind and tide and with some difficulty reached St. Mary's a little before night. Mr. Hulbert opened his doors to receive us. Although we had to leave many of our things and was not well prepared for the Sabbath, yet I felt happy and nothing troubled me.
John Fierst, as you've gone through these letters, what has it felt like for you as a Michigander and a librarian and a documentary editor to really touch and read through these pieces of our state's past?
Well, I think it's a great way to get a feeling for the past. The idea behind this was that there's nothing like the story that's told in a letter. There's so many nuances in a letter. There's so many details that you don't pick up by just hearing. For instance, if the library has the Bingham papers, or the library has the Orlando Poe papers, Orlando Poe being a general in the Union Army. But to actually read the letter is, in some ways, to give you the details that allow you to really put yourself back into the past and into that person's life. So I'm a great fan of letters and documents. The actual primary evidence, going to the primary evidence to get a sense of history.
The online collection of letters can be found on the web at michiganinletters.org. That's michiganinletters.org. And we have been talking to one of the contributors, John Fierst, with the Clark Historical Library at Central Michigan University. John, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Still to come, with more people turning to their mobile devices for just about everything, what does this mean for consumers and for businesses? That story's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You know, we have had many conversations on Stateside about invasive species, usually the type with scales and gills, such as Asian carp. Today, we focus on invasive species with chlorophyll, yes, non-native plants invading ecosystems in the Great Lakes. Let's find out more now as we welcome Jo Lattimore. She's an outreach specialist with the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Michigan State University, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
How widespread is the risk that invasive plant species pose to our lakes?
It's pretty widespread indeed. We have over 11,000 inland lakes in Michigan, and the aquatic plants, particularly in the inland lakes rather than the Great Lakes, are really a concern all across the state, from the southern part all the way into the Upper Peninsula.
And I'm interested, why is it that the Great Lakes aren't impacted by this?
Well, because of the depth of the Great Lakes and the size overall, plants aren't, in most cases, a big problem in the Great Lakes, sometimes algae and things like that. But it's in the inland lakes, in the shallower waters, okay, where we really see the impact of plants.
All right. What are these plants and weeds? What are those, some of the main ones that most concern you?
There are quite a few that we have our eye on. Probably the most commonly run across is Eurasian water milfoil. That one's actually been present in Michigan for at least a decade, probably more, and really infests dozens, if not hundreds, of lakes in Michigan. Certainly, there are plenty of lakes in Michigan that aren't infested with milfoil, but we certainly are seeing more and more all the time.
And where does this unwelcome invader come from?
Well, as the name implies, it's Eurasian, so it's coming from Europe and Asia. But now it's got a real stronghold in Michigan. So what we're seeing more now is the movement of the plant within Michigan and within the Great Lakes region. So since it's become established, it moves very easily between lakes, and we find new infestations of it all the time.
Give us a sense, Jo Lattimore, what is it that plants like Eurasian water milfoil do to our lakes? Why is it more than just an annoyance? And I suspect you're looking at an economic perspective as well as an ecological perspective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ask anyone who lives on a lake that didn't have this plant before and now does. They'll have a whole list of things that they are concerned about. First of all, milfoil, Eurasian milfoil, when it grows, grows very thick in a lake and will crowd out and shade out all the native plants. So you end up, instead of having a diverse native community of plants that supports fish and all the invertebrates and frogs and everything that normally live in a lake, you have nothing but Eurasian milfoil. It grows very quickly, faster than a lot of our native plants, grows to the surface, and then begins to spread as a mat across the surface. So you end up with a lot of shading, and you're not going to get a boat through there. You're not going to be able to swim through there. It's not good fish habitat. Ecologically, it's a concern. And, of course, with the boating and fishing and just the way it looks, certainly there's economic impacts, too. On lakes where tourism is very important to the local economy, boaters and anglers are going to stay away. They're going to fish elsewhere. They're going to go elsewhere because this lake is no longer enjoyable to spend time on.
What's the cure for these aggressive non-native plants like Eurasian water milfoil? What's to be done?
Well, I wish I could say there was a simple cure for this, but if there were, we wouldn't have as big of a problem as we do now. There are herbicides that can be applied that are selective for Eurasian water milfoil, meaning that they're less likely to damage any native plants, but will be specific for Eurasian milfoil. Unfortunately, these are very expensive, and they're not 100% effective. And there's the problem. You end up with a few plants that are left behind, and they just spread again. And so what you end up with is this cycle of management. So many of our lakes that have significant milfoil infestations end up having to do treatment in perpetuity because it never really gets to the point of eradication. And of course, there's concerns about adding chemicals to lakes too. A lot of people are uncomfortable with that. And so there are other approaches that are taken. Often the first approach that's taken is, well, let's harvest it or cut it or kind of mow it just to keep it down and limited. But the problem with this particular plant is that fragments will grow new roots and spread even further. So if a mechanical harvester is deployed in the lake, unless every last fragment is collected, all those pieces will simply float about the lake and infest new areas. The same thing can happen on a smaller scale if someone goes through with a boat motor. That propeller is going to chop it up and all of those fragments can become new plants.
What a nightmare.
Yeah.
Seriously. Are there other plants as well as the milfoil that are causing concern?
Yeah, there are. And we are looking at a lot of them, some that are present in Michigan lakes. One called curly leaf pondweed is one that raises a lot of concern in some lakes. It's interesting. In some lakes, it doesn't seem to cause a problem. It simply becomes part of the plant community. But in others, it can really become a nuisance. And what we're most concerned about and where my focus tends to be on is on prevention and early detection. So preventing these plants of getting into our lakes as best we can in the first place. And if they do get in, having local citizens knowledgeable enough and vigilant enough to catch them when they're still very small populations, and treatment is more likely to be effective.
So what is the major prevention step?
We find just from where we tend to see the plants is usually around boat launches. What we're finding is that these plants can easily be transported from lake to lake by trailered watercraft. So, of course, boating and, again, fishing and a huge, huge part of the recreational economy of Michigan. And we're trailering our boats all over the place. And if we're not careful to keep those boats and trailers and other water equipment clean, there's a real risk of spreading those plants from one lake to another without even realizing you're doing it.
So the to-do for boat owners?
Clean, drain, and dry is what we always like to remind people of. Cleaning your boat simply by looking at it and physically removing any plants that you see. If you have access to a boat washing equipment to hose that boat down, that's a great idea. Draining out any bait buckets or live wells or places where you might be transporting actual water from lake to lake is really important. Mm-hmm. And at the very least, just let your gear dry for a few days before you move it into a different water body, and you're really reducing the chance of spreading those plants from one to another.
And what can concern folks who want to help in the early detection part of things? What can they do?
Well, learn about these plants. We have a really successful volunteer monitoring program here in Michigan through the Michigan Clean Water Corps, or MyCorps. It's a partnership between the Department of Environmental Quality, Michigan State University, Great Lakes Commission, Huron River Watershed Council, a number of groups across the state that train volunteers on inland lakes all over the state on how to identify these plants, because many of them, including Eurasian water milfoil, look very much like native species that we also have, which can make it a real challenge unless you're trained to know what to look for and how to notice when you have a plant that just is not what you're supposed to have in your lake. So we offer that training to volunteers. We'll answer questions. People can send in photos or report what they see, and that will help us detect and respond to those infestations early when they're much more manageable.
How much of a priority are these invasive plant species with the Department of Environmental Quality, with the folks in Lansing?
Oh, there's certainly a priority. There's a whole aquatic invasive species program within the Department of Environmental Quality and in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources, the DNR. And it's very much focused on early detection and rapid response, being able to respond quickly and have folks that know what to do when we find these plants in our lakes to actually get out there and, as I said, remove them as soon as possible. There's a whole management plan in place there. So we're well equipped and prepared to respond to early detection incidences, and hopefully that we can support and keep these infestations, or at least the new infestations, to a minimum.
Jo Lattimore, she's an outreach specialist with the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at Michigan State University. We will put a link on our website that will get you to the information about detection, about responsible boater behavior, and also for anyone who wishes to volunteer to be part of this citizen corps to help fight back against Eurasian water milfoil and the other invasive plants. Jo, thanks so much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, quick. Think of a recent purchase you made. Well, chances are mighty good that your mobile phone was somehow involved, whether you tracked down a store location, you checked out products and prices, or you even closed the deal and made a sale on your phone. One survey done by a digital coupon website found that more than half the consumers they surveyed used their mobile device while they bought something in March of this year. Or let's talk dollars and cents, lots of dollars and cents. Mobile commerce transactions are expected to hit $1.5 trillion this year. And by 2017, you can look for that to top $3.2 trillion. Clearly something big is going on. And we wondered what's in store for consumers and businesses as more of us trade walking through the door of a brick and mortar store to a few thumb clicks on our smartphones. Well, joining us is Mike Vichik from Ann Arbor. He's the CEO and co-founder of Glyph. It's a mobile app that lets you pay with your mobile phone and also keep track of what you're spending. Mike, how has the increasing sophistication in our mobile phone technology changed the way that businesses and customers are interacting?
Well, thanks, first of all, for having me on the show. I think, if you ask any parent what they find about their children using mobile phones, they'll tell you that their phones are glued to their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true, I think, also when people go out into the store, as the studies you suggested to also corroborated. I think there was actually a study done by a venture capitalist in California that said people check their phone 150 times every day.
I don't doubt that. I absolutely would be among that.
Yeah. So the concept of showrooming, where these big, you know, Best Buy, Staples, big brick and mortar stores are becoming showrooms for Amazon.com, is a trend that is going to continue. And I think that's a risk for a lot of traditionally brick and mortar oriented merchants. And the question is, how do you actually turn that into an opportunity?
Absolutely. So what we're talking about with showrooming is where I might walk in, take a look at that washing machine and then go, okay, thanks, or that whatever, and then go home and buy it online.
Absolutely. Or even worse, take the phone out of their pocket, scan the UPC on the product, and then have Amazon tell you the cheapest place you can buy it.
Ooh, okay. So it isn't just something that a small merchant has to cope with, because I have talked with merchants who say they'll come into my gift shop, look around, find that special piece of jewelry and say, okay, thanks, and walk out. And they know that that sale is going to some online company. That's tough for the small businesses. I've actually seen signs saying there's going to be a charge if you don't buy something. So the big stores, the big box stores and the chains have to deal with this as much as the little individual guys.
Absolutely. And traditionally, the smaller stores haven't been as well equipped. They typically don't have the data resources that a big retailer would have. So they don't have people sitting at the corporate HQ analyzing trends and patterns of how people shop. It's just the judgment of the store owner. So one of the things that I think that we are addressing at Glyph is to kind of give merchants and consumers a way to better connect and make smarter decisions between the two of them.
How so?
So to give you an example, for consumers, what we do when someone is in a store, after you download our app off the App Store, you tell us simply which credit cards are in your wallet,
mm-hmm.
not the card numbers or anything, just the type of card. So you'll say, I have an American Express Platinum or mm-hmm. a Chase Freedom. And then when you go into the real world out to buy something, what you do is you tap a button on your phone to open the app, and then we'll show you a list of merchants that are nearby. And once the user selects the merchant that they're at, the next screen they see is which credit card in their wallet will give them the most rewards on that purchase.
Okay. So not only are you tracking spending, you're also looking for those extra goodies.
Yeah, absolutely.
It helps you to do that.
So that's how we got started, was by helping consumers make smarter decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found in talking to merchants was that there was a lot of interest from them too. And specifically, they're always, especially small merchants, are looking for ways to find new customers and keep existing customers. So when you look at it, and let's say that on average, you go to your favorite restaurant once every 10 days.
All right.
What happens if it's been 15 days or 20 days since you've been there? Right now, there doesn't exist a channel for that merchant to get in front of you and say, hey, we'll give you, you know, a free drink when you come in, or 5% off, 10% off your purchase. So Glyph is a way for them to actually do that and to begin to engage their consumers when they want to be engaged.
Mike Vichik, what do you think is the bigger force right now, e-commerce and online shopping or m-commerce with your mobile phone?
Certainly where the growth is mobile. Mobile commerce, being buying things online. And we're not yet seeing what I call mobile payments, which is really in-store purchasing yet. So I think e-commerce is kind of – it'll grow, but at its traditional pace. M-commerce is more explosive. But I think the one that once we figure out how exactly to help consumers and merchants in a physical store, that's the one that hasn't been cracked yet, and that's kind of at Glyph what we're most excited about.
What kind of trends do you think we should watch for in this world of mobile commerce?
Well, I think data is a trend that you can't ignore. Data and transparency that data brings.
What do you mean when you say data? What, for instance?
Prices, right? So this this washer costs $700 at Best Buy, and online it's available for something less than that.
Okay.
Right. So that would be one example. Another one is data on what credit card rewards you're going to earn.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say data, I mean things that enable consumers and merchants to make smarter, more informed decisions. That's something that's not going away. So I think the key thing is how do you actually use that to your advantage as a seller or a buyer? And Glyph is trying to help take that data, that intelligence, mm-hmm. and then make sure that everyone knows about it and then help people make the best decision.
And can a merchant build loyalty amongst customers when they've got that little smartphone in their pocket and can go anywhere and access it? Can you still have that customer loyalty?
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, you could probably describe it as loyalty is dead, long live loyalty. Because loyalty might mean something different. It means you have to engage your consumer in a different way. It's not a card you send them in a mail. Things are going digital. So if you can engage with them, whether it's through a social media platform like Facebook or Pinterest, or through a commerce-focused platform like Glyph, I think there are definitely ways to build loyalty. You just have to think differently about it, and it doesn't mean the same thing that it did 10 years ago.
Mike Vichik is the CEO and co-founder of Glyph, and that's spelled G-L-Y-P-H. And this is a mobile app that will let you kind of search around, see who will give you the best deals, and also who will give you the most rewards on your credit card.
Absolutely.
And interesting app and interesting conversation. Thank you so much for joining us today, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
The 9th Annual Traverse City Film Festival kicks off tomorrow. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has this preview.
The festival sold 91,000 movie tickets last year. This place is going to be mobbed. And with 150-plus films and a new theater opening this summer, the festival organizers are hoping to bring in even bigger crowds. Of course, the festival is the passion project of Michigan's Michael Moore, so you know two things are a safe bet. One, plenty of liberal-leaning movies that will push the political envelope, like Citizen Coke. It takes a withering look at Republican political donations.
More than $3.5 billion has been spent making this election the most expensive on record.
And you know there will be love from Michigan movies and filmmakers. That includes Paul Feig, who grew up in Mount Clemens. He went on to make Bridesmaids and this year's female spin on the buddy cop flick, The Heat.
Could you just close the door on the way out?
I'll shut the door on you. Will you lay down here, put your head in the door? And I'll slam it about 157,000 times.
Aw, girl, you better run.
For Stateside, I'm Kate Wells, Michigan Radio News.
Today, Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today is Tony Brown. Contributors are Allie Billings, Austin Davis, Erica Decker, Emily Fox, Katie Theory, and April Van Buren. And special thanks today to Jackie Stickney and Andrea Ledhoney. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.